Okay, imagine for a second that you're in a really tight spot financially.
Right.
You bought a house that was way too expensive. Maybe you leased a fancy car you didn't really need. And suddenly the bills come due.
Yeah.
And you just decide, nah.
Yeah.
You just ghost the bank, stop answering the phone.
I would not recommend that as a financial strategy.
No, of course not. Because in the real world, if I try that, a very specific, very aggressive machine
Yeah.
just gears up.
Right. The bank forecloses.
They seize the house, they repossess the car, my credit score is, incinerated, and a bankruptcy judge steps in and liquidates everything.
There's a police force, basically, an enforcement mechanism that says you have to pay.
Exactly. But now let's scale this up. Imagine you're not a person, you're a country.
Yeah.
You're Argentina. You're Greece. You've borrowed billions of dollars and you decide we can't pay. Who comes to collect?
And that is the trillion-dollar question, because there is no global repo man.
You can't send a sheriff to seize the capital city.
No, you can't foreclose on a national park.
And that is the wild and frankly kind of terrifying reality we're diving into today. We're looking at Chapter 24, Sovereign Debt and Default Risk by Juan C. Hachondo and Leonardo Martinez.
Right.
And this whole deep dive is about what happens when you strip away the one assumption that holds most of society together, the idea that you have to keep your promises.
It's a fascinating area because most economic models just assume full commitment.
That people always pay.
Always. But for a country, repayment is, well, it's a strategic choice. And when it becomes optional, the rules of economic gravity just sort of turn off.
So our mission today is to explore that world, the world where countries can and do just walk away from the bill.
And we should be clear, this isn't just about poor nations or, ancient history.
Right, the source material covers everything.
Everything. The Latin American crisis in the 80s, sure, but also the 2011 euro crisis.
Greece, Spain, Portugal.
All of them. When trust disappears, the dynamics are exactly the same.
Okay, let's get into what you call this upside-down economy. I want to start with something that honestly felt really backward when I was reading, this idea of consumption smoothing.
Right. The standard logic.
In my own life, I try to save for a rainy day. If I get a big bonus, I put some aside. If I lose my job, I could dip into savings, maybe borrow a bit, just to keep my lifestyle steady. I smooth things out.
Exactly. You smooth out the bumps. And that's what households and wealthy established countries do. They borrow in bad times, save in good times.
But this chapter says emerging markets do the exact opposite.
They do. It's a phenomenon called procyclicality.
Okay.
The data shows that in these economies, consumption is actually more volatile than the economy itself.
Wait, let's just pause on that. That sounds insane.
It does.
It means that when the economy is crashing, they cut their spending even harder than the crash itself.
That's right.
That's like starving yourself because you're hungry. Why would any government do that?
Well, the force argues it's not really a choice, it's a trap.
A trap.
Think of it like this. In a rich country, when a recession hits, the bank hands you an umbrella, a low-interest loan, to keep you dry.
Okay.
For an emerging market, the moment it starts to rain, the market snatches the umbrella away.
So right when they need a loan to keep hospitals open, the window just slams shut.
Precisely. It's all about credit constraints. When a risky country hits a downturn, investors get scared. They worry about default.
And the interest rates.
They skyrocket. The country effectively loses access to credit, so they're forced to tighten their belts right in the middle of a crisis.
That's brutal. It's a vicious cycle. You're kicking the economy while it's already down.
Which just makes a recession worse. And it all comes back to the risk of default.
Yeah, let's define default because I used to think of it as a simple on-off switch. You pay or you don't.
It's much more subtle than that. The rating agencies define it as any restructuring of debt that results in less favorable terms.
So it's more like a forced negotiation.
Exactly. The country says, look, I owe you 100 million. I don't have it. How about I pay you 60 million over 10 years instead?
And a lot of this happens before a payment is actually missed.
Yep. Surprisingly, about 38% of these are preemptive. The government sees the wall coming and tries to swerve.
But for the investor, it's still painful. You use this term, the haircut,
Right.
which sounds mild, like a trim, but it's not.
No, it's violent. It's the percentage of the debt that just poof vanishes. The average present value haircut is about 37%.
So if I lent a country $1 billion, I'm just losing 370 million on average.
On average, yeah. And this all happens at the worst possible time for the country. 60% of defaults happen when GDP is already below trend.
Kicking them while they're down.
But the real cost, I think, is the hangover. This isn't a quick fix.
It's not over in a week.
Not at all. It's a messy, drawn-out divorce. The average time between the start of a default and a final settlement is 3.2 years.
3 years.
3 years of being a financial pariah, locked out of global markets while your economy back home is just starved of capital.
And I assume you can't fund schools or roads or anything during that time.
It stagnates. And this brings us to the sovereign spread. You hear this on the news all the time.
I do, but I admit I usually tune it out.
Mm-hmm.
Why should a regular person care about a country's spread?
Because the spread is the price tag of fear.
Okay.
It's how much extra interest a risky country has to pay compared to a super safe bet, like a U.S. Treasury bond.
It's the risk premium.
Exactly. And the source breaks down what drives that premium. There are four main things.
Let's hear them.
Three are obvious. One, if you have a huge pile of debt, your spread goes up.
Makes sense.
Two, if your economy is growing fast, the spread goes down. And three, if you have a vault full of cash, foreign reserves, investors feel safer, so the spread drops.
Okay, richer, faster growing countries with savings get better rates. Fair enough.
But then there's the fourth one. And this is the one that just feels so unfair, the VIX.
The fear index.
Right. Global market volatility. A country can be doing everything right, paying its bills, managing its budget. But if the VIX spikes because of panic in New York,
their borrowing costs explode anyway.
Exactly. They get punished just because the global mood changed.
Wow.
And the cost is staggering. The source points to a study on Italy during the Euro crisis. They asked, what if the spreads hadn't spiked because of pure panic?
And what was the answer?
Well, Italy's GDP was going to fall by about 3.2% anyway, a recession. But because fear took over and spreads exploded, GDP actually fell by 6.4%.
So the fear of a default literally doubled the economic damage.
It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. And we saw the same thing during COVID. Countries that went in with high spreads were paralyzed.
Right when they needed to borrow the most.
The cost of borrowing went through the roof. It's a system that seems rigged against the countries that can least afford it.
And that leads into this idea of debt intolerance.
Right. The idea that not all debt loads are created equal.
This was the comparison between, what, Thailand and Turkey?
Exactly. Thailand and Uruguay can handle debt over 50% of GDP, and the markets are, you know, relatively calm.
But Turkey?
When Turkey hits those same levels, its risk premium spikes. The market just doesn't trust them with the same load. And a big reason for that is something economists call original sin.
I love the dramatic names.
Yeah.
What is the original sin of finance?
It's a country's inability to borrow money abroad in its own currency.
Ah.
The U.S. borrows in dollars. Germany borrows in euros. But if you're a developing nation, investors say, sure, we'll lend to you, but you have to pay us back in dollars.
I can see the problem immediately. You earn your taxes in pesos, but your mortgage is in dollars.
And that creates a mechanism of doom. Your economy hits a rough patch. Your currency crashes, say it loses half its value against the dollar.
Suddenly, your debt burden just doubled overnight.
Right when you were at your weakest. It's a death spiral. The currency crash makes default more likely, which scares investors, so they sell more currency.
Which makes the debt even heavier.
It's the single biggest predictor of fragility.
So, we have a system that punishes you for being poor, for global fear, for borrowing in the wrong currency. My question is, why do governments even play this game? Why borrow so much?
It's a deep problem in game theory, something called time inconsistency.
Okay, unpack that for us.
All right. To get a low interest rate, you have to promise with 100% certainty, I will never, ever default.
Right. You have to be a safe bet.
But here's the problem for a government. You cannot control your future self.
I see.
A government today can't physically prevent a future government from defaulting 5 years from now if things get tough.
Right. I can't put handcuffs on the next guy in my job.
Exactly. And the market knows this. They know a future government will do what's best for itself in that moment. So because they know you can't commit to being good forever.
They charge you a higher rate today.
Yes. And that creates a perverse incentive. Because you're already being treated like a risky borrower, you're more likely to act like one.
It's like if I'm already paying insurance rates for a reckless driver, I might as well drive fast.
Sort of, yes. And then there's one more layer to this called dilution.
This is about new debt hurting old debt.
Precisely. Imagine a country owes $1 billion. Now they borrow another billion.
So now they owe $2 billion.
Right. But by doing that, they've made the old debt riskier. The probability that the first group of lenders gets paid back in full just went down, the value of their bonds is diluted.
And a real-world government, in the moment, doesn't really care about the old investors.
They just want the cash from the new loan. It leads to what economists call overborrowing.
So we've laid out the trap. How do we get out of it? What are the remedies?
Well, since there's no global bankruptcy court, we have patches. One tactic is borrowing in a foreign jurisdiction.
Issuing your bonds in London or New York.
Exactly. A country like Ecuador does this to signal, look, we're serious. You can sue us in a court with real teeth if we don't pay.
So they're voluntarily tying their own hands to gain trust.
It lowers the interest rate. Another tool is fiscal rules, like the Maastricht Treaty in Europe.
Just putting hard cap on debt, like 60% of GDP.
It sounds sensible, but remember, debt intolerance. A one-size-fits-all rule is tricky. 60% might be too tight for a stable country, but way too loose for a volatile one.
You can't give the same diet plan to everyone.
Exactly. And we should just briefly mention low-income countries because they're a bit different.
They're not borrowing on the open market.
Right. They mostly rely on official debt loans from the IMF, the World Bank, or other governments. And more recently,
China.
China's Belt and Road Initiative has changed the landscape, but the fundamental risks are the same. It doesn't matter if your creditor is a hedge fund or a state-owned bank in Beijing. If you can't pay, you're in trouble.
So we've painted this picture where sovereign immunity, the fact that you can't seize a country's assets, actually makes it harder for them to borrow cheaply.
That's the ultimate irony. And it connects to a final thought I wanted to leave with you. We see this immunity as a good thing. It means a bank can't seize the presidential palace.
We like our sovereignty. We don't want banks running countries.
But I want you to just ask yourself, is this immunity actually a curse?
A curse? How so?
Think about it. If a country could be foreclosed on, if a bank could legally seize a port or a tax stream with no friction,
the risk to the lender would disappear.
And interest rates would plummet. Capital would be free-flowing. They could borrow cheaply to build schools, hospitals.
They could potentially escape the poverty trap.
Exactly. But the price would be giving up control. A world where banks could literally own pieces of nations.
So the current system, which protects sovereignty, traps them in high interest rates and default cycles.
That is the trade-off. Which is worse? Being owned by a bank or being starved by the bond market?
That is a terrifying and fascinating question. If you could mortgage your country's freedom to save its economy, would you do it?
A heavy thought to end on.
Indeed. It really forces you to look at those debt crisis headlines in a completely different way.
Thanks for listening to this deep dive. We'll see you next time.